Welcome to our episode of Revenue Chat. Today we have Michael Tellinger, an author of four books, a scientist and explorer, who's become a real-life Indiana Jones, making groundbreaking discoveries about advanced civilizations in Africa. Now, while his research and discoveries are very intriguing, it is his theories and view of money which caught my attention, as they are profound. Michael tells us how to survive in a financial catastrophe. Next, on Revenue Chat. Hi, everyone. This is Tony D'Urso with Revenue Chat, brought to you by the book Easy Sales Procedures. With us, we have Michael Tellinger, a real-life Indiana Jones who's made earth-shattering discoveries about our origins and vanished civilizations in Africa. However, we're going to talk about money and surviving a financial catastrophe. Now, before we bring him on, let's set the stage for today's chat. Now, up to now, all of my shows have been on how to generate revenue, how to increase and grow your business, and so forth. But what if our financial system has another meltdown? In 2008, the U.S. suffered the worst economic depression since the Great Depression. And it is no secret that financial pundits are predicting the fall of the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency. The U.S. is expected to drop down to a position equivalent to the end of the British Empire in the post-World War II period, per Jim Rickards, a financial threat and asymmetrical warfare advisor for both the Pentagon and CIA, who makes serious predictions about our financial future. Using price signals to determine the actions of participants in the market, whether it be terrorists or strategic rivals of the United States and so forth, Jim predicts a worldwide economic breakdown and collapse, an extended period of global anarchy, a 25-year Great Depression. He says the U.S. is insolvent. We have $17.5 trillion of debt. We have $127 trillion of unfunded liabilities. There is no way to pay back those debts. Today, we only make 3 cents in growth for every $1 of debt, and there are far more factors that herald this inevitable collapse, which would spend about another hour to discuss in detail. A study of Rickards is recommended to learn more of these financial catastrophe flashpoints. And another factor that can bring financial collapse is through solar flares. NASA stated, a powerful coronal mass ejection, CME, tore through Earth's orbit on July 23, 2012. If the eruption had occurred only 1 week earlier, Earth would have been in the line of fire, end quote. Now, if this had hit the Earth, we would have seen serious power blackouts, the grid going down, if not more serious consequences to humanity. All financial institutions would be shut down. Everything, in fact, every electronic device in the world could literally be fried and rendered useless. And also, a man-made EMP could have similar destructive capabilities, depending on where it is detonated. Historically, we know the government may be slow to respond to emergencies. So what do we do should the inevitable financial collapse occur? How do we survive and carry on with our business if that is possible? Enter Michael Tellinger, today's guest on Revenue Chat. Michael Tellinger is an author of four books, scientist and explorer, and is a real-life Indiana Jones. While his research and discoveries are very intriguing, it is his theories and view of money which caught my attention, as they are profound. Now, I'm looking at all this from the point of view of how do we conduct ourselves when in a state of financial collapse. Michael discovered something unique about money and postulates a world without money, in which people live in united communities in support of each other, rather than the divided communities in fear of each other that we find ourselves in. Michael's site is michaeltellinger.com. Well, let's see if Michael can help give us some guidance of what to do when and if the inevitable financial collapse occurs. Hello, Michael. How are you?
Hi, Tony. Lovely to be speaking to you, and thank you for having me on your show. You're a very brave man to bring me onto your show.
Okay, please don't scare me, Michael. But I know we're going to have a lot of fun. First, I want to thank you. I want to thank you so much for being on our show. I know the hour is late for you, and I sincerely and deeply thank you.
No, it's great, and I love your introduction because it really does set the scene very nicely. You know, it's and for people like you who talk about economic planning and projection and saving and money growth and all that, this is a theory like mine or a plan like mine to actually take humanity away from money completely is obviously the other side of the scale.
Yes, and that's a good intro here because, Michael, you are extremely accomplished in a number of professions, and each one you've become a master of. And let's talk about money, which is, of course, the interest of the show. And I'd like to know, please, how did it all get started for you? How did you become so good on money and know all this?
Well, you know, it comes through my archaeological work and looking, exploring the origins of humankind from a scientific perspective, an archaeological perspective, genetic scientific perspective, microbiology, astronomical, and looking at all the areas that I could scratch open to find more real, interesting, and a different perspective on who we are, where we come from, and why we're here. And without going into too much detail there, you know, I've discovered really advanced ancient vanished civilizations here at the Southern Africa that left behind really advanced technology, which I describe in my lectures as silicon-based technology in the most profound ways that is boggling the minds of some of the world's leading leading scientists today. With the result that my research has now created the various laboratories in the United States that are studying this ancient technology left behind in stone tools that are not basic stone tools, that are really advanced technologies. And we're learning about resonance and sound and frequencies and phaser beam technology from ancient civilizations that go back further more than 100,000 years ago. And it was during my research into all this phenomenal breakthrough historical activity that I realized that there was a time when humanity lived without money and money did not exist. And that really started to trouble me. I said, well, how is that possible? Because I grew up with the assumption and the belief that, like everybody else, that money has been part of human evolution, that there's always been some sort of form of barter and trade or exchange. And to my horror, I discovered that is not the case, that people, human beings in very, very ancient times, where, you know, I'm talking about dates that most archaeologists and historians are very uncomfortable with, more than 100,000 years ago, when there were advanced beings that lived on this planet, and my physical and scientific evidence shows this without any doubt. So I started asking the question while I was researching all this ancient stuff. Say, well, what would a world without money look like? How would we survive? How would we buy stuff? How would people get on with their lives? What would we do without competition? What would be the purpose? What would drive humanity? Because as you probably would echo the sentiment that most people believe that without money there'd be no driver, no purpose for people to get up in the morning and so forth. And I started to realize, as I started to imagine a world without money, the moment I removed money from the equation, things changed so dramatically, but in ways that I least expected, not for the worse, but for the better. And the more I evolved this model, a world without money, the more I realized that money was actually the problem in the world and not the solution. And then I started to research more about the origins of money, only to find that it is not what people think. And I'm going to start rambling on now, but what I'd like you to just, you know, throw the ball in your court now. Most people have no idea where money comes from, where it originated, how it came to be what it is today, who introduced money into humanity, and at which point was money introduced, and how it evolved or became what it is today. Or did it evolve? Did money evolve into what it is today? Or did it originally start this in the same way and the same fashion that we use it today? And those answers are quite staggering and profound.
This is quite interesting. I love it. Please, don't worry about rambling. Tell us all you know about money. This is such a unique point of view. It's refreshing and also a little embarrassing when you hear the end of the show, the next guest that I'm going to introduce for next week. Please don't be mad at me because the show is about making money. But this is such a refreshing point of view, and I like to explore all possibilities. And please be my guest. Tell us all about money.
Well, you know, what I'd like to just say to you, what you said, you gave me the key phrase. Now, I just want to tell you that I've been doing this now for 11 years, going around the world and talking to thousands of people around the world and talking to them about a world without money. And what happens, the consequence of when you remove money from the system, I'm not saying you take money away from the people so that they have no money to buy stuff with. I'm saying we change the system so that we don't need money to buy things, so that we actually create abundance without the need for money. Take money away as the hurdle or the obstacle to progress, because at the moment, that's all it really is. Money has become a hurdle to progress for virtually everyone in the world. And we've become obsessed with making money instead of creating abundance. And there's a big difference. Money, you can't eat money. You can't eat gold. We need food. We need water. We need shelter. We need the basic needs, healthcare. We need to learn skills. We need engineering, rocket science. We need clothes, cups and saucers, and gardening. And we need technology and computers. But we don't need money. Money keeps getting in the way of us creating all these things. What I always tell people is that, money does nothing. People do everything. People plant the seeds, grow the food, develop the technology, solve the mathematical equations. People have create the most beautiful works of art that reduce others to tears. Money can't do that. And so what has happened with money, it's become the tool of control over humanity. And people have become obsessed with making money, and they forget about their humanness and their humanity and the reason why they are born, to give expression to their creative abilities that are suppressed and controlled by money. So I want to come back to the statement I made where most people have no idea what money is, where it comes from, how it appeared on planet Earth, how humans started to use money. And this is where it gets really interesting, and this is where the research into the origins of humankind and ancient civilizations becomes a very important tool. Because very clearly we find in the Sumerian texts, in the ancient Sumerian texts, which incidentally remains the oldest transcribed literature or language that we have, and millions of clay tablets, Sumerian, Babylonian, and the Near East clay tablets have been discovered, and hundreds of thousands have been translated. And we find phenomenal information about the ancient past on planet Earth, and what the Sumerian tablets refer to as a time before time, where at another ancient time where strange things were going on planet Earth, and these Sumerian texts talk about the gods, and they talk about these other beings that come from outer space and in great detail. Now, I know that this might be too much information for some of your listeners, but if you're a scientist, you've got to keep an open mind and you've got to work with the evidence. I often say you've got to do what the guys in the TV show, the CSI TV show, you've got to follow the clues and the evidence and determine your conclusions based on the clues and the evidence, not on belief systems. So what the Sumerian texts tell us that there was a time when kingdom was lowered to earth from heaven, and at some specific point in time, the first kings and royalty, the royal bloodlines, were imposed on planet Earth. There were a bunch of people chosen by the gods to become the kings and became the first priest kings and the royal bloodline on Earth. And that, incidentally, is the origins of the royal bloodlines we have on Earth today. They go back to those Sumerian times that the Sumerian texts talk about, but it could be a lot further back in time because they also refer to about a time before time. Now, what these priest kings then did is they suddenly became the owners of all the land, and this is where we get the real estate concept from, as in real in French. It's better understood if you pronounce it in French. It's real, which means royal, royal estate. Suddenly all the land belonged to all these kings, these royal bloodlines, and people became their subjects. And these royal kings and priests were given advanced knowledge and advanced weaponry and tools with which to subdue and smite the people unless they obeyed these royal priest kings. But they did something even more important that affects us all, and this is why you have your show, and there are thousands of shows like yours all about money. These first priest kings lived in their temples. The temples became the first banks, and they were the first people that created money. They started to create money in these temples, which were the banks, and the first forms of money were actually clay tablets. They assumed the right to print on clay promissory notes, bills of exchange, and all forms of financial documents that were printed in clay, the same way that our banks create money out of thin air, basically, and printed on pieces of paper today. These first priest kings were the first individuals to issue these bills of exchange, promissory notes, negotiable instruments, and all these items that are traded by banks and financial institutions today. And this goes back about 6,000 years ago, to the best of my research. And they would then issue these clay tablets to people that would bring pieces of silver or gold or anything like that, mostly silver and gold, that they would ask people to bring into the temples, and in return they would give them these pieces of clay that then became the first forms of money, physical, actual money in the people's hands. Not pieces of silver, but actual printed clay tablets. And this is spectacular. So the same method that the banking system is using today worldwide was already used 6,000 years ago.
That's amazing. Give us your gold and silver, and I'll give you clay. I love it.
Yeah, isn't it? Now therein you start seeing the con and the farce. So all the hard work that these people are doing, again, the obsession with gold and silver is a whole other story, but I don't want to go down that road. Why the people were mining gold, and this is an obsession that goes back to the Garden of Eden in biblical stories, right? We can't escape a human obsession with gold. It is inextricably connected to our species and who we are. From the earliest of time. And so it's fascinating. You know, people would bring their gold and silver, and they, as you say, they get in return, they get a piece of clay. It's a very unfair exchange, isn't it?
Okay, anyone who wants to do that, just let me know. No. That is yeah. Crazy. Now, Michael, did they do that, to be the devil's advocate here, did they do that because they couldn't carry around pounds of gold and silver, which gets heavy? The clay might be lighter, though maybe not too much lighter, but maybe the clay can have inscribed in it greater amounts of money. Was that just a means of to bank their money and be safe with it?
Well, that's what most financial schools and economic schools would like to claim, but I believe that that's not the case. That was just a very cunning and malicious way for these royal bloodlines to collect all the gold and silver from the people and give them nothing in return. That's always been like this. Remember, in the United States, it was in the 1920s, everybody was forced to hand in their gold. I forget the exact date. Now, just imagine that. I mean, that's insane. Mm-hmm. Imagine if that happened today. What would the people do today if everybody was forced to hand in all their gold? There'd be a bloody riot on the street. Yeah, so...
Very interesting. Well, actually, in the United States, I don't know about anywhere else in the world, but there are stores that have sprung up all over the place for, I don't know how many years, 10 years or more, and it's a gold exchange. Bring your necklace, your gold rings, your gold teeth, bring whatever, and they'll give you cash for it. However, I went into the store once and I asked and inquired about that, you know, what's the exchange rate? And I don't remember all the details anymore, but it was something like you would get 10%, maybe if you're lucky, of your value in cash. And the store, of course, they have to justify their existence. They keep it all. And I asked, where does this gold go to? Who is the buyer at the other side? And they said, it's the government of the United States. And there are thousands and tens of thousands of stores out here and people on the street with signs, give us your gold for cash. But they're just taking it away from people.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly what it is. And obviously, there's a very deep mystical reason, ancient historical reason for this gold. What people don't know is that gold exists in a different form called the monoatomic form of gold. But I don't really want to go into that because that takes us very, very far away from the question of finance and money and banking and how it's become what it is today. So basically the fundamental bit of information that I want to share with your audience and those that are in the know is that the entire global financial system is a maliciously constructed system, and all it is just a tool of enslavement to control people through money, giving them the illusion that they are free. And basically what has happened is through these priest kings that emerged on Earth some 6,000 years ago, maybe further back in time, these royal bloodlines that have held on to the control of the gold and the control of the issuing of money are still the same bloodlines today that are connected to all the banking families. And these are the guys that run the global financial systems. And they have the exclusive right to create money out of thin air. And we all work like slaves to pay them back. They invade countries. They invade governments. They bribe. They replace governments when they feel like it because they have absolute power. In fact, the independence wars in the United States were all about the attempts of the Rothschilds and the Bank of England to take control of the United States, which was posing to be a huge threat to the banking families if they did not subscribe to the private Rothschild banking empire, and they succeeded. They succeeded. Look what's happened to the USA. And you know, 1913, that pretty much with the establishment of the Federal Reserve banking system in the USA. So there's another way of looking at it. You know, there have been various countries, including the USA for periods, and many other countries around the world that have had periods where they did not have these private banks. I must make something very, very clear. With me and the Ubuntu movement, because that's who I represent. I represent the Ubuntu movement, which is an African word for unity within community, and that shows that ancient civilizations could coexist and live in abundance with no money, and we can do that even better today. We're just going to figure out how to get from here to there. We can't go from zero to hero overnight. We got to figure out how to go through the various steps to release ourselves from the enslavement of the financial systems. I don't think there's anybody alive today, quite frankly, that is happy with the way the world is going, that is happy with what the government is doing to us, what is happy with what's happening in the financial systems, people that are happy with inflation. People are miserable. They most people dislike their lives. They're very unhappy in their life. There's hardly anybody alive today that believes they're living their life's purpose, that they're living absolutely the dream that they wanted to live. So something is wrong with the system, and the system has failed us. So as Albert Einstein says, you know, we can't carry on doing the same experiment over and over again expecting different results. We've been working with money for more than 6,000 years, and this is where it got us. So there's got to be something else we got to do. So with the Ubuntu movement, we propose that we actually get rid of money completely and replace it with a system of, instead of competition or the whole capitalist system that's based on competition, that we replace that and start to work in cooperation and collaboration. And suddenly, the moment you do that, you realize how everything changes, how this whole world of scarcity that's driven by corporate greed and corporate control and corporate supremacy, the control of the many by the few, and the absolute control of the banking institutions that have infiltrated our countries and our government and pretty much taken all of us hostage in our own countries through being the highest authority in the country. Remember, the Fed in the USA, the Federal Reserve Bank or system, does not belong to the government. It operates outside of the government of the United States. It is a private enterprise that provides money and financial services to the government of the United States. I mean, that is insane. And the same is happening in every other country. So just the first step that we propose with the Ubuntu movement, the first step to release, take the, what I call to take the lid off the pressure cooker and just relieve the people of the financial and economic stress and woes and the debts and the inflation and taxes and rates and fees and levies, and everything is taxed. Everywhere you go, you got to pay for everything. The moment you replace the private central bank, in the USA it's the Fed, in South Africa it's the South African Reserve Bank, the Bank of England, the Reserve Bank of Australia, the Reserve Bank of India, all these banks that are all controlled by the Rothschild Banking Empire, which is a private corporation that is run and controlled from Basel, Switzerland, as you know, and they pretty much control all their private satellite offices, which are the central banks of the countries. So the moment you just remove the Fed and replace it with what we call a people's bank that issues money for the people by the people, which in that instance becomes tax-free, interest-free. There's no need for any taxes, levies, or inflation of any kind. And the money simply becomes a tool to mobilize and activate and stimulate the engine of the people of the country that starts public works, that starts millions of community projects that benefit the communities, uplift the communities. The People's Bank, is its job is to fund and provide the means, the money as a medium of exchange, so that everything and anything that people want to do in their communities becomes possible. So this, what we call the People's Bank in the Ubuntu movement, is not the final destination, but is the first most critical step. If you want to stimulate a country, if you want to stimulate economic growth, if you want to stimulate the creativity of the people and allow them to express their God-given talents, or the natural-born skills that they've got, or their passions, and stop working like slaves in companies and corporations that they don't like just to make ends meet and pay their bills and put their children to school and pay for electricity and buy bread and milk and just to do it all over again next month, that slavery ends immediately the moment you implement a people's bank. Because you can then move to the smallest town, the smallest village, anywhere in the United States, anywhere in the world, for that matter, if you have a people's bank in your country. And if you start a community project that is there for the benefit of the community and at the same time for your own benefit, that project will be automatically funded by the people's bank. And you never have to pay that money back. Why should we charge ourselves interest if we create our own money? This is why the idea of countries becoming insolvent, you know, how is it possible that a country with 100 million people or Ireland or Greece or any country, how can you have a country that's filled with living, breathing human beings that wake up every morning and go to work and create incredible abundance? How is it possible that they are indebted to some corporation called a bank? It's insanity just to even think about it. And the fact that banks get bailed out by the governments and the people then have to pay the debts, this just shows you how the banks have taken control of the governments and imposed their will over the people come hell or high water.
Michael, this is really profound, and I could go many ways, many different directions with this, but let me try to bring this to usability for the business. We have business people, entrepreneurs, yes. People who work from home, all sorts of business. And this is amazing, and we probably could spend a lot of time going down all these points, but what can a business do, okay, to survive in a financial catastrophe? You know, money becomes more worthless. How can they go from where they are to where perhaps would be a better way, as you say, with the Ubuntu contributionism type idea and philosophy?
Well, Tony, it's really important to realize that the entire structure of society today is based on the capitalist model and where money drives and controls every aspect of our lives. I mean, really, literally every crack and crevice of our existence is controlled by money. So this is not a simple thing, you know. And actually, let me rephrase it. It is a very simple thing. But first, you need to wrap your head around it and say, okay, we need to find a new system. This is, you know, I can spend the rest of my life trying to make money, and then I'm going to die, and then what? I've had a miserable life, been chasing money all my life. You know, I want to have fun. I want to enjoy myself. I want to paint or sculpt or hang glide or scuba dive or do things I want to do to experience the life on this planet to its fullest extent. And most people would agree with that. Most people want the same thing. They want to be happy. They want to be content. They want to have food. They want to have roof over their head. They want to have friends. They want to have a beautiful life. Now, we can't achieve that as long as we've got this ever-increasing debt growing around ourselves. And we're so focused on the debt and the alleviation of poverty instead of focusing on the creation of abundance. And this is what the Ubuntu movement and the Ubuntu plan and philosophy is all about, is let's stop focusing on the alleviation of debt and uplifting the poor. Let's start focusing on how do we create abundance for everyone, not just some people because they're lucky and they just managed to meet us at the right time. The moment we start moving away from this current financial system, this capitalist competition-based system, and we start moving into a contributionist where people contribute their talents and skills for the benefit of everyone in the community, so everybody benefits from it. It's not a system of barter and trade or exchange. You know, I'll trade you my eggs for your chicken, for your sheep or whatever. This is not what we're talking about. We're talking about whatever I do for my community and I do it for myself. And everybody benefits from what I do. So with the Ubuntu movement, we propose that we use small towns and villages as the starting points, as the triggers to initiate this kind of interaction and participation of people to start these kind of communities. And it becomes very simple once you start putting the plan of action together. And we've got a simple model to set this up, and it gets so exciting because the moment you start working with this, and a lot, just first of all, you got to drop your defenses, because you know the first thing we do when you start talking to people about, and I know I've been doing this for long enough, so I know what questions people start to ask. I call them the 13 frequently asked questions, because it's like a stuck record, you know. What I find fascinating after doing this for 11 years now and showing people how we can live, not only remove ourselves from money, but actually the moment we remove ourselves from money, we create abundance of unimaginable proportion in technology, in arts, culture, in food production, in rocket science, in everything imaginable in our lives and more, infinitely more. We create in abundance the way that we cannot imagine in a capitalist and a money-driven world, because we've removed the money as a hurdle. If you know, if we want to build a bridge, let me put it this way. I think your listeners may appreciate this, right? In the United States, for example, and I'm sure that you have listeners outside of the United States, so this applies to all countries of the world today, South Africa included. Suddenly, all our roads have got toll gates on them. Suddenly we have to pay to drive on the roads that when I was a child, you could drive anywhere. There wasn't a toll gate in sight. What happened? What happened here? Well, a very simple thing happened. the government sold our roads to private corporations. And they put up toll gates and they're charging us to drive on what is now their roads. It's now a private company that owns our roads. I mean, this is insane. We need to remind people that we appoint our government as a servant of the people, not the slave master of the people. The government should be doing what we want them to do for us, and this has not happened. And they've used the money and financial systems to create new laws and structures and pretty much sell our countries from underneath our noses. And if this continues, our children have nothing. So this is actually for the youth. This message and the Ubuntu message is not so much for the older generation, but for the youth, and especially in the United States, where the students that go to university will probably and most likely end up paying for the rest of their lives to pay off their student loans. I mean, this is insane. So how do we get out of this? We use the small towns and the models to implement this concept of contributionism instead of capitalism, where people work together in cooperative structures and collaborating to create abundance. Everything from growing food to arts and culture to technology to creating new supercomputers to creating energy devices that give us free electricity to bringing the healers out of hiding that know how to cure cancer and how to cure all disease. We know that the free energy devices have been created. Many of your listeners will be familiar with people like Nikola Tesla and others that have been around for more than 100 years that have given us free electricity that were shut down by the Morgans and the banking families because it wasn't good for business. And you start seeing the evils of the banking institutions that have imposed themselves on the people because it's not good for business and not for their control over humanity. This is why it's critical to move away from the money system and create abundance, not scarcity. Once again, let me repeat this. Most people, when you tell them we're going to remove money from the system, they immediately go into panic mode thinking, oh, you're going to take my money away so I can't buy stuff. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying we're going to change the system so that you don't need money to buy anything. Everything is available because we do it together in our community.
That's amazing.
So the abundance is incredible. Just imagine, you live in a town, a little small town, and you suddenly you decide you need to build a bridge to get to the forest because it's you've been going around the river and crossing the river down there, and the community decides, let's build a bridge so we can get to the forest, and it'll be much easier to get the wood from the forest so we can bring it to our lumber yard. So you get together as a community, you build a bridge, right? At which point do you give that bridge to a private corporation so they can charge you money to use the bridge that you built? Right?
Wow.
It's an insane idea, isn't it?
And yet it's and done to this day.
And that's what we're doing today. And in all aspects, if we as a community decide to create a communication device between all the people in our town, and everyone's got a little cell phone type thing, and we can all communicate, we set it up and we put it in place, and everyone's got a way to communicate with each other. At which point do we hand that to a private corporation that then charges us to use the phones and to phone each other? We're not going to do that, are we? So you can see how the entire structure of our countries has been hijacked to use people as the slaves, and money is the driving tool. When money, this is the other important thing, is some researchers refer to money as a Babylonian magic money slavery system, which was originally what was called for a long time. And it's weird because it does strange things to people, you know. It's like puts a spell on people. It sends them into a frenzy. You know what money does to people? It makes people commit crimes. It makes them kill their families. It makes them shoot themselves because they lost money in gambling. Money is just tainted with all the dark energies that we shouldn't even have to deal with as living, breathing human beings of flesh and blood and infinite soul.
That's quite a concept, Michael. It's impressive to think with having money. We're so ingrained. We worry about it. We stress over it. We fret over it. Yet, how do we do our business? First of all, back up one second. This contributionism, this is in place now and in practice. How successful is it?
Well, it's not in place in practice. There, They are, however, I mean, you know about the kibbutz model in Israel, right?
A little
and,
bit.
And that's probably that's probably one of the best examples that I can quote, because the kibbutzes in Israel, where people come and work, they live in these wonderful communities, everything is available to them, and they work and they create abundance. I mean, some of these kibbutzes have become so wealthy. They're exporting technology, they're exporting textiles, clothing, anything you can imagine. And they've turned the kibbutz that consists of people that work together, they've turned it into a giant machine. Now, there's one thing missing there, is that the people inside, they don't really benefit from it. They are still used as the slave laborers, as volunteers in a way. Now, this is where the Ubuntu plan and model differs. And once again, we look at the wisdom of the ancient civilizations and echo that. This is what the word Ubuntu means. It's an ancient African word that means unity within community. Or the most commonly described definition is, I am who I am because of who we all are. And all ancient cultures right across the world have their own version of Ubuntu, where they lived and existed in abundance without money. So our whole model in our plan of action is based on converting small towns and villages into these Ubuntu communities, contributionism communities, where people contribute their skills and talents, and then everybody benefits. So imagine if you take a little town, and I must also say at this stage that we use electricity as the tool of unification. Right?
Okay.
Now, I know some people might struggle to follow this, but remember that the Ubuntu movement is also a political party. And it's being registered. It's a political party in South Africa, the Ubuntu Party. It's registered as a party in the United Kingdom. It's being registered in Australia and Canada and the USA and Austria, Germany, all over the world. So we can already see that there are millions of people around the world that resonate very strongly with this very simple philosophy. Otherwise, it wouldn't be growing organically. You know, I'm not doing much. It's just happening on its own. So what we do is we use electricity as the tool of unification. We find our own source of electricity, so we're no longer reliant on the supply of the big electricity giants that basically keep us hostage through the supply of electricity. Our town gets its own supply of electricity, whether it's hydro turbines or solar or wind or new exotic technology that we know exists. But most of the inventors of these alternative free electricity devices live in fear, and they live in hiding because they know what has happened to others like them every time they expose this free electricity device to the world. They just either vanish or disappear, or they get threatened, or their things get bought out from them and shelved. We find our own source of electricity, and everybody in town gets free electricity, uncapped free electricity. All the businesses, the factories, everything. I'm talking about small towns now, you know, 1,000, mm-hmm. 2,000, maybe 5,000 people. And so everybody gets uncapped electricity. But in return for that electricity, everybody contributes 3 hours a week towards one of the many community projects that we set up in our communities. So what we've done instantly, in return for this free electricity, because we put the electricity device in. So once it's in, we've installed it, we've paid for it, it belongs to us. The river doesn't charge us for the electricity. We get it for free from the river. We have to maintain it and keep it maintained, but that's part of the community project. So now you've got a town of 5,000 people, 3 hours a week, you've got 15,000 hours of labor a week. That you've just turned your little town into a powerful labor force that no corporation, no government department, no municipality can compete with. 15,000 hours of labor a week.
Wow.
You know how many community projects you have to set up just to put those people to work. And that's just 3 hours a week from everyone in the community. What this does, Tony, is it provides a model for people to not upset their daily lives. You can still, nothing changes. You can still have your job or work in the bank or drive to the neighboring town to work at the dairy or whatever. But for 3 hours a week, you work in one of the community projects in your own town. Under the supervision of a master trader, master baker, or master carpenter, or a master shoemaker, or a master rocket scientist, or a bridge builder, or engineer, whatever the community project is. What this does as well is these projects are really well managed and set up and funded by the money that comes from government. Because this is what we base with a plan of action with the Ubuntu Party, the political party. Once we win the majority in a town, this is what we will do. We take the money that comes into the town, we find our own source of electricity, we plug our town into it, it's free for everyone. We establish all these community projects with the money that comes from central government. Because at the moment that money is being used and misused and misappropriated, and we never see any benefits from it, especially here in South Africa. Money goes into politicians' pockets and it never gets to the people on the ground. I'll give you an example. Our little town where I live gets 3 million rand a month from government, and we get about 5,000 people in our town. That's about $300,000 a month from government.
Okay.
If we start what we plan in our manifesto, we propose 20 to 30 community projects. If we allocate 50,000 rand a month per community project, and we have 20 projects, that's 1 million rand a month. So we've used 1 million of the 3 million rand, and we've established 20 community projects, well managed, well looked after, well controlled, so that they create abundance, not just what we need, but more. We create at least three times as much as what we need for our community. Now we start to implement this thing, the laws of nature that I call it. We don't just turn our town into a self-sustained community. We turn it into a community of abundance. So whatever we then create in those, the dairy, the bakery, the fish farm, the wood factory, the metal factory, whatever it is we do, we use up the one third that we create for ourselves, and we got two thirds that we then sell to neighboring communities. But because
awesome.
we're doing it ourselves, we can sell it very cheaply because it's costing us virtually nothing, right? Labor is the most expensive part of any business today. So suddenly, because you got free labor because of all the community projects, we can sell everything that we create very cheaply, which means we'll underprice the Walmart and any other supermarket. So we'll be selling everything very, very quickly and bringing in huge amounts of money into our community to those community projects. But now that money belongs to the people of the community. It doesn't belong to a private company or some individual that lives in a foreign country that's exploiting the people of your town. All the money that we make in these community projects comes to the people of the town. And the money then gets used to keep upgrading the community projects, and the rest of the money gets distributed to the people of the town equally. As long as you contribute your 3 hours a week, you get free electricity, you get free food, you get free everything that we create in those projects is available for free to everyone that participates. That's how simple it is. The abundance of money that comes in keeps upgrading the projects, and we keep creating new projects that create components for other projects. If we've got bicycles and we need bicycle spokes, then we set up a community project that makes bicycle spokes. And if you want to start a horse breeding community project because you love horses, you'll be supported because the horses will be utilized in your community. So what we then do is we invite all the existing businesses and factories to join us and turn their business and their factory into a community project. The benefits to the existing factories is they get free electricity, no rent, no rates and taxes, free labor, free components. If they're making wooden doors and windows, they'll get their free wood from our sawmill. They'll get free glue, better glue that they can buy from our chemical laboratory, because our scientists will be making better glue, stronger glue, which is non-toxic and biodegradable, and it will be free to the people in our town, which is because the glue factory is part, one of the community projects. Can you see how quickly this thing just grows exponentially, because we are cooperating, we're not competing. We're helping each other on every level, and every community project is connected to everything else. So, you know, this is just such a simple formula for success. What this does as well, it just attracts all the creative minds, all the great scientists, the inventors, the healers, the engineers, the artists, because whatever you want to do in that community will be supported. And you'll be given all the tools necessary to make it a success, because whatever you do will ultimately benefit everyone else in your community.
It's a great concept, Michael.
I'm
sold for 3 hours a week. I'm ready for free electricity. I'm ready to start.
You know, there are 168 hours in a week. You work for 3 hours a week in the project. And next week you'll work in the bakery, then the next week in the metal factory, and the next week in the engineering, and then by the time you've finished, and sooner or later you're going to say, wow, I really like this fish farming. I want to spend. Can I work more time? I want to spend a lot of time in the fish farming or in the bridge building or whatever. People have different passions. Now suddenly you're no longer going to be restricted from following your passion, because it's there, available for you. You can choose to go and spend more time in the engineering works or the fish farming or the dairy or the whatever, and they'll welcome you with open arms, and you'll learn your skills. What happens in this community of contributionism is that within 2 or 3 years, you've got such a well-informed community that can do everything and anything, because you've done it hands-on as part of your community projects. And then after 168 hours a week, you still have 165 hours left to yourself. What are you going to do with all that time?
To do your own projects, write your books, make your movies,
yes.
play
yes.
your music, etc. I
yes.
love it.
Yes.
So now, Michael, we're approaching near the end of the hour, and there's a couple of topics I wanted to take, which you can finish what you're saying, but if we could cover, please. Like, how does one start? And also, any other tips that people can take away in the concept of surviving in a financial catastrophe? Let's say the stock market, something hits next week. How can people bridge into this, which really sounds great? How could we get started in something like that, please?
Well, I think the most important thing for people to realize is, if you look at all the major disasters, you know, all the tornadoes, all the wars and so forth, the moment there's a disaster, the people start standing together and helping each other. And the moment the disaster is over, they go back to their separate lives controlled by money. Isn't it weird?
It's true.
So
you're right.
It's almost, you know, when disaster strikes, it brings people, shakes them out of their money slavery and their capitalist way of thinking, and it brings them together to work together for the benefit of everyone, to help each other. So in essence, a disaster would probably be a good thing to shake us out of this money slavery system and bring us into this world without money, where we create abundance and realize that money does nothing. People do everything. And there's very little advice I can give the people, other than the plan of action that we have. You can go and find a little town and share this idea with them, and try and convince them to implement this philosophy in the town, and hopefully you'll find a bunch of good, conscious, wide awake people, or a town that's filled with conscious, awake people that love the idea and want to participate and do it together. Alternatively, we're using the political platform to inject this virus of consciousness into the political beast, because we can't allow the disgusting, crooked, filthy, inhumane political arena that currently controls and destroys our lives, we can't allow it to continue. So we've got to do something about it. You know, sitting on the fence and throwing stones at the political thing is not going to help. You've got to get in there to change it. We've got to change the political system to be an honorable, respectable part of humanity that actually serves the people and not enslaves the people. And that's what we're proposing with the Ubuntu Party as a political party. And it's, as I said, it's growing around the world. We have a very simple plan of action and philosophy. I've shared some basics with you today. And I hope that this will start resonating with people and let them, you know, think out of the box. The sky's the limit. There are no boundaries whatsoever because there's no money that will ever restrict whatever dream or whatever it is you want to do.
That's awesome. I love it. It's got me thinking. You've shared with me much more than I knew about it at the start of this episode here of Revenue Chat. You've opened up my mind to all the possibilities, and it's like, yeah, people just get together when there's an emergency or some big situation, tornado, whatever. They get together. There's no thought about money. It's just all about giving, helping, and getting everything back to a status quo, which, of course, then that status quo has to be with everyone is then a slave to the money, as you say. It's quite an interesting concept. You've really opened up some eyes on this.
I'm glad you got a whiff of it there tonight, Tony.
A whiff indeed, a whiff indeed. We're just about ready to wrap up. Is there anything else in closing that you would like our audience to know about, Michael? Oh, your website is michaeltellinger.com. I believe there's links there to find out more about Ubuntu and contributionism. And anything else you'd like to say?
Well, and also the party is ubuntuparty.org.za. That's the political party website. There's a lot of information about the money system, our plan of action. So people that are interested in finding out more about the plan of action can go there.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. Well, I want to thank you very much, Michael. Truly thank you for staying up late, being on the show. It's been an honor and a pleasure to have you. It has been so interesting. Just an hour just flew by. So thank you again.
Thank you, Tony, and keep doing a great job that you do. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, again, everyone, Michael's site is michaeltellinger.com. And again, thank you, Michael. It's an honor to have someone like you on our show. Thank you again, everyone, and stay tuned to our next show on Revenue Chat, which I'm embarrassed to say. Michael, hold your ears. We're going to have David Barnett, a two-time Amazon best-selling author, who says, "What do you know about that others don't? The key to successfully getting ahead is to leverage your knowledge and skills." That's his quote. His big dream is to become infinitely wealthy by having passive income streams that exceed his monthly living expenses. He's moving fast and high on this goal and is going to share with you how to do that on our next episode of Revenue Chat. This is Tony D'Urso, brought to you by Easy Sales Procedures. Get the book, Easy Sales Procedures, for you and all of your business contacts at TonyDURSO.com. Until next time, and remember, you can make life better for yourself and everyone. Choose wisely.
Hi, this is Tony D'Urso, author of the new book, Easy Sales Procedures. You know, in my career, I've made impressive record-breaking sales forays into real estate, collectibles, insurance technology, and other varied industries. My accomplishments include raising $3.25 million in a six-month period. Now, despite what we've been told, sales is an art. There are sales procedures that can be applied precisely as a science, but in essence, it's truly an art. There are fundamentals that you need in place that will help you with your sales, marketing, and business. Get Easy Sales Procedures to help put your business into proper perspective. You know, too many people seem to make sales complicated. Hey, it's easy. All you need are some basics in three words: open, agree, and get. That's it. That's EasySalesProcedures.com. This book will endow you with the simple truths at the core of being a sales master, and also contains salesman training drills that, when practiced, demonstrate how to interest any person in anything. These simple procedures can be applied by anyone from any walk of life, because in modern day society, every person is involved in interesting or selling someone something. That's Easy Sales Procedures. Get your copies now at a low price from EasySalesProcedures.com. Order enough for all your employees, too. Here's to volume sales success for your life and business.